I'm Kevin Levi Green, and this is the Quiet As It's Kept podcast. I am so happy that you're still with us. I'm inviting you to join me on a journey as my dance company creates a new work exploring sexual trauma through the lens of Southern Blackness. Tecmoje is the only Black arts organization, at least with a budget, in the 25-county region of Coastal Carolina. We see our work as a rebellion of sorts, so I'm going to take a few minutes to talk with you about that and how our position informs the creation of Quiet As It's Kept. Thomas DeFrance, who is one of my absolute favorite people, will be joining us for most of this episode. He is a scholar of dance and culture whose knowledge of dance's impact in queer spaces and Southern Black culture is truly unmatched. I've always been a rebel of sorts. At School of the Arts, I enjoyed learning all of the dance forms from modern dance pioneers. But while I enjoyed learning those dance forms, I didn't identify with them. They didn't feel like they were authentically me. And so even though I was cast in many of the school's dance performances and concerts early on in my time there, and I enjoyed those, I still felt like I wasn't fulfilling my purpose. I want to say it was about my third year of college. Because of my rebellious ways, as far as pushing the envelope on assignments, I was put on a sort of probation where they would not allow me to perform. And that was like the last 2 years of my time there. And so what I did was I spent a lot of time in the studio because I didn't have to be at rehearsal. And I started to really dig into what my truth was, what my authenticity is as a dancer and choreographer. And so when I went back home post the death of my father my senior year, I thought about how I didn't have access to these things. I didn't even know what modern dance was when I was younger. I didn't know what it was. And so I was like, wouldn't it be great to take this back to my home and expose people to a dance form that doesn't get much attention, and a dance form that is transformative and does a very good job of allowing room for interpretation and storytelling. Tecmoje has created its own choreographic vocabulary, reflective of where we're from. And it's also rooted in my experience of living in coastal North Carolina. And so we may not be your traditional classical dance company. There's room for everybody. Well, I am super excited because I am being joined today by a dear friend, mentor, colleague. I don't know what we call this relationship, but Thomas DeFrance. Thomas, can you tell our listeners who you are and what you do?
Oh, I'm happy to. Thank you so much, Kevin. I'm really glad to be here joining you and everyone who's listening in. I'm Thomas DeFrance. I'm a professor of dance and a dance researcher and an artist. And I work in the spaces of queer discovery, African-American studies, dance historiography, and lo-fi technical live processing events in dance creation and performance. Those are some of the things I care about and I'm excited about. And I'm really glad to be joining you today.
I'm very happy that you were able to, and I'm so happy that you're here. Today, I wanted to, you know, I'm doing Quiet As It's Kept, the evening length work, and I wanted to talk to you today about the intersection of race, sexual trauma, healing, and Southern culture. How does modern dance present at these intersections?
That's such a great question, and there's so many layers to it. So let's just start in and see where we end up going. This question of what dance can do and how it kind of acts in these interstices between things like queer and gay identities and being in the South, and especially people of color, Black people in the South, but then also in relationship to our white kin, if you will, you know, because they're part of our families too, sometimes, if not often. You know, one way to think about this, Kevin, I think dance operates as a kind of binding agent. So in sharing dances, we can learn things about each other, but also understand points of similarity and, you know, really simple difference. We feel rhythm differently according to how we've grown up and where we've grown up and who taught us things. So Black communities tend to feel rhythm and understand its power in really particular ways that white communities tend to borrow from Black communities. And we see this in modern dance. Modern dance helps us understand how rhythm generates a sense of identity. So that was just a lot of different ideas. Let's see if we can pick one or two of them out together to chase them down.
Because you know how we are. We'll go on and on and on.
It's true.
One thing that you said that was very interesting is how we feel rhythms differently. Mm-hmm. Depending on where we got our education in this, mm-hmm. or yeah. our innate abilities mm-hmm. from our communities and our okay. environments. I was just sharing with someone the other day that my dance, like my voice, my choreographic voice is mm-hmm. a collection of experience that I've had, right? So it's not necessarily one form of technique that I've learned, you know, like Dunham or Limon, but it is a collection of my life experiences. You know, I did step team, I did track, I did all of these things, and they all play a part in the way I choose to express myself through movement and choreography. Mm-hmm. And they do affect, especially coming from the tap world too, they do affect the rhythms. And so I would be interested in expanding on that.
No, that's a great point. Thanks for bringing that forward. And even like putting the step team next to Limon or Dunham is really helpful. So, you know, the step teams are coming out of Black cultural formations, and mm-hmm. stepping as a practice is clearly related to all kinds of rhythm-based dance forms from the continent. Like, that's just obvious. But then Congo Square, in the context of the United States, in New Orleans, is a place where people are doing physical drumming. But stepping actually becomes a form of dance practice after World War II. And it's super interesting. Like, it shows up in the Black fraternities and sororities as enlisted people come back to the U.S. and are sort of elaborating on marching drills and creating sort of fraternal organizations and places for men and women at that time to be kind of segregated among, you know, men among men, women among women, creating these kinds of teams that are like parade dress teams and demonstrating rhythmic innovations alongside the military drills. And this becomes the foundation for the step societies that we have now. So because these are Black organizations, there are lots of Asian and Native and Latinx and white people who participate, but they come from Black cultural formation. You know, Black people might have two or three generations in stepping activity, and that'll influence how we understand Limon, Jose Limon technique, to be, you know, useful in making a dance phrase. So I just want to lift up your premise that all of our experiences go into the fabric, the warp and the woof of making a dance, especially for someone like yourself as a choreographer. Like, all the things that you've experienced become part of how you might imagine a movement to unfold. So the step team is really important. Also, dancing the Laffy Taffy or something from TikTok is really important because it's a way to understand rhythm and its capacity. And then to pour that into modern dance and into live theatrical performance makes a shift in what the dance can do and how it's organized.
I also am very curious because, you know, what should we be thinking about when we're creating a work such as Quiet As It's Kept? what should be our thinking? And are there examples of works that come to mind from other choreographers or companies around this theme of sexual trauma that come to mind for you?
Mm-hmm. You know, creative work, artistic work that is actually concerned with events in people's lives outside the theater, it's just really important that these works come into being. And they don't come forward all the time. Sometimes people feel they need to make performances that are about a color or a feeling or a mood to make work that is coming from the space of thinking about sexualized trauma or racialized traumas. You know, this is really urgent work. It's important work and it's difficult work. It gives us a chance to imagine together, yes, at things that have happened to us, but also at what kinds of worlds we want to live in. How do we want to be near each other? And what would it mean to understand a capacity to say no, or to, you know, help someone else through their challenges around sexual assault and sexualized violence? So I just want to lift up again how important it is to do this work. It's not work that happens all the time. So, you know, I can think of someone like Bill T. Jones, who's a choreographer living in New York City, who's made works over the years about different aspects of marginalization or events that have been really life-changing. That's one artist I think of who's been pretty consistently concerned with how could we make art and performance that helps people understand a different sort of way to move through the world. I guess that's the thing that's important to me. I'd love to hear you talk about that. What is it that you want the piece to do, the work to do for people who experience it?
Well, when going into this and deciding to throw myself, because you know that's what we do, we put ourselves completely into a process. The process, I realized, was born out of how long it took for me to be able to talk about my personal experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for someone like me who is immersed in the arts, you know, all forms of it, musical theater, concert dance, orchestral music, mm-hmm. I think if I would have had access to something very much like this evening length work, it might have helped mm-hmm. me to understand that I'm not alone in something, you know, I'm not alone in this situation, and that maybe, you know, if that person had the courage to come forward mm-hmm. and to take on not only their story, but other people's stories.
That's right.
That maybe there is a place for me to share what has happened and help me begin healing, you know, help me begin moving towards a place of healing. And so I'm hoping that this work will be that gateway.
That's right.
For some people to be able to see it and know that they're not alone. Or, you know, if they know someone who has experienced it and they've shared it with them, to understand the importance of encouragement and support and uplifting. So it's a lot to ask of the work to do. And I'm sure that everyone's experiences coming from the performance will be different, but I think at the heart of it, it will make people braver and bolder in the ways they go about dealing with something that is traumatic.
Beautiful. That is such an empowering kind of statement to make around your artistry and especially this particular project. And it is about a kind of acknowledgement and uplifting and the sense that people can then recognize if they didn't know this was happening, that it's happening, but if they've experienced it or they know someone who's experienced something like it, that it matters that we tell these stories to each other and find ways to actually share so that we can heal, just as you said. So I think that that's what art can really do, and dance performance can do that. And this work in particular will do that. So that's, you know, that's the why of why we make this work and what we want it to do in the world as well. So that's just lovely.
Thank you. I'm grappling with this idea of responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to get your take on what it means to be responsible mm-hmm. to the audience when presenting this work mm-hmm. about trauma. Like, what yeah. strategies can we use before presenting, during, and after?
Yeah, I think a conversation like this helps. So creating a context of information, a kind of web of information that audience members can then refer to is really important. That's part of a kind of ethical relationship to working through difficult concerns in creative work. I think it's important to consider a bit how an audience might respond. I mean, you can never know what someone else is thinking, and you can't make someone think something. We know that. At the same time, we can ask questions as we're constructing difficult work and kind of get a sense of what sorts of responses seem most likely, and then think together with your collaborators on, well, you know, we want to move people towards this possibility rather than that. So, you know, we're not making the work to traumatize people and make them feel worse about themselves. So to be sure that that's not happening, it's important to try out sections with people and then to ask as many people as possible how they're responding to the work as it's being in development. And then for me personally, this is quite personal though, I always think it's useful to offer a world we want to live in, you know, like to offer a kind of healing possibility. I just think that's part of the story, so that we don't live always in the kind of burnt out post-apocalyptic Netherlands, you know, so much science fiction these days, but we actually move towards a world where there is housing equality and mental health care and, you know, the possibility of fewer food deserts and people finding ways to be themselves among each other. Like, you know, as artists, maybe we get to model that a bit too. What would a healthier kind of a relationship to intimacy and being near each other, what, you know, what could that feel like? Mm-hmm. I don't think that has to be in every single piece, obviously, but I right. think in this work, as you're asking, to also have that as part of your own creative process with the collaborators, like, well, you know, what else could this look like? And maybe that doesn't end up in the final piece, but to just be thinking in that way towards a healing possibility, I think is part of the challenge as well.
And so would you say that this is the kind of thinking, you know, as we go forward, that would work in like a higher education setting too?
Definitely. I do think it's important to especially allow higher ed younger researchers and young scholars and young people who are in higher ed to imagine differently. So it's one thing to help young people understand that sexual violence is real. Mm-hmm. And it's still, you know, that statistic is still 1 in 3. For male presenting, female presenting, and non-binary people, it's still 1 in 3 will experience some sort of sexual assault in a lifetime. So we want to, you know, be sure that people know that so that they're prepared to counsel or care for a friend if that should happen, or to understand that they're not alone. But then we also want young people to imagine a world where that's not true. So I think it can be hard to imagine things if there's no modeling of it. So that's why I do think it's important to, or it could be important to imagine beyond the world where trauma is so every day.
So, you know, it's very interesting to me, this conversation around, you know, responsibility. I'm very curious, when you go into a work that has to deal with some form of social commentary, how do you balance the entertainment part of it and the social commentary?
I think it does have to do with, that's where performance really takes the lead. So we can move into performance practice that's quite angry and defiant and maybe aggressive and belligerent. And yet there still has to be the thing that demands to be watched or experienced. For my own work, because you asked me, like, in my own work, and, you know, this fall I'll be presenting a couple of social commentary pieces through my laboratory in Durham, North Carolina. And one of them is white privilege. So this is a very pointed sort of assault on white privilege. And it's mm-hmm. a talking dance. So there's a lot of talking and a very tiny bit of dancing. And the assumption is the audience is that the audience will mostly be white. So then what I have to remember as a performer in that piece is that my job as a performer is to bring these people into the conversation, not to simply you know, lambast them with information without considering our relationship. I do the piece because I want to bring the people into the conversation. So then as I remember that, Kevin, I'm able to craft a performance that does a lot of different things simultaneously or one after the other. So it's at turns beguiling, or it's funny a little bit in places, maybe some of the stories, or, you know, the performers will be indignant, but then that'll melt into some sort of assembly where people seem to be nodding in agreement. So to me, I think it's a matter of letting as many different kinds of elements and types of information into the stream of performance can help this kind of work that's committed to a social possibility to come forward so that the audience can actually respond to it and feel involved in it.
Yeah, it's very difficult, you know, sometimes, because you do have to consider that idea that you don't want to create this defensive wall that they might put up based on the subject matter, but you also don't want to cheapen your work, right? So it's like that balance of ensuring that there's no idea of like bulwark, you know, in there in between that defensive wall is very, very important. I'm so glad you spoke on that. So, you know, we're dealing with COVID-19.
Yes.
You know, what are, in your opinion, the realities of COVID-19 and dance?
I mean, for live performance, smaller performances, venues that were built to seat 1,000, if we only have 300 or 400 in that same venue, then it actually there's a sort of measure of safety and protection for everyone who comes. So again, things being scaled down instead of being constantly scaled up, I think is a reality that we're looking at. You know, performances that might have been for 300 now will be for 75. And I actually think there's something really important and dynamic about that too, because we're encouraged to speak more carefully and intimately in these smaller settings with each other. So I do think that more is possible in performance because things are smaller, especially, you know, kind of experimental or modern dance. You know, our audiences will be smaller and they'll be more, hopefully, committed to the ideas that are inside the work. But I'll say something else, Kevin, like another thing that's happening because of COVID is screen-based performance. So this idea that we might make a film that'll be seen by 5 times as many people as the live performance. And that becomes part of how we think of what the piece is. So the piece will have podcasts, as this one does. It'll have, you know, short film objects that are part of the project, so that the projects now start to take different shape that include digital media as well as live performance. I think that's a reality moving forward for all of us in the arts, and especially the performing arts.
Well, you know, that place is of importance to me. As you can see, I still make work and have created a platform in my home, you know. And so would you consider that to be a part of modern dance, or how do other choreographers represent place in their work?
I was just working on a project with an artist who's based in, well, they were based in Philadelphia, but now they've just moved to Durham recently. They're based in Durham, North Carolina now. And their project had 3 different sites. It had a site of the theater, so that's most familiar. But then they also made a place outdoors. So part of the project revealed itself outdoors in the streets of the cities where the project was playing. So outdoors became a place that was important to this artist and this project, you know. So I just think that we're all working with place in a little bit of a different way. And digital media, the internet, if you will, or the cloud, become a place. They're a place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can film something and edit it to our content and then share it out on Vimeo or on YouTube or on Facebook or on Instagram. And that's actually a place where dance can also happen. And I think that's, you know, now in our current condition and moving forward, that's a very respectable place for modern dance and experimental art to be represented. So yeah, place is important. I also know people are performing, as you mentioned, in their homes as well. So really intimate spaces with 20 audience members. I actually was in a performance in Brooklyn earlier in the summer where there was a limit of 23 in the audience. because it was a small stage in someone's backyard in Brooklyn. And it was a quite special performance for me. I was starting to show a little bit of a new piece I'm working on now. So I do think place matters in a really different way now than it did before COVID-19.
So you know how you were saying the performance was done in a backyard, right, for 23? How are we thinking differently of these traditional tour models? Right. So like what are some ways of thinking differently when we go out into spaces? And do we even go to the traditional theater? Does the community think different and respect the work, you know, with it being in a different place? Is there support for that? I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think there is. We're in a big transition moment because of the pandemic. You know, we hadn't experienced something like this globally in recent memory. It'd been 100 years since the last pandemic. And now we're trying to refigure what does it mean to be a professional artist, if that's language that's helpful. What does it mean to be a working artist, a performance artist? And I do think that the rules or the expectations are shifting. And I see that in the United States, our model is based on state and foundation funding. There's very little government funding. There's a tiny bit, but mostly it's more local, like city, county, and state funding, and then private donors and small foundations. And all of those organizations are funding our new approaches to how to share work. But I do think people are touring much more modestly, if that was a thing. So if you were thinking you were going to show your piece in 5 different states, you know, at 20 different venues, maybe it's a smaller kind of release than that. And again, there's a podcast or a film that goes out to thousands more people than the live performances do. But I'm seeing a lot of support for these new models for performance that are smaller. And one thing to remember too, though, Kevin, is that the population of the planet keeps growing. So I like to joke and say that, you know, every day there's more people on the planet who will never see our work. As the population keeps getting bigger and bigger, there's more people to never come. So, you know, another thing to think about is how live art and experimental performance and modern dance, you know, we're drawing larger audiences than we did 10 years ago. It's still a tiny number of audience compared to the population of the planet. And there is still support, though, for the work that we do and interest in it. So, you know, I think it's a little bit of a mixed bag. There are some things that are very similar and some things that are really different. But I do think everyone's being a bit more modest than they were thinking 2 years ago.
So you said earlier that this new work that you're white privilege, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the whole idea is that hopefully you'll be presenting it to white audiences. Would you say that, you know, are white spaces worth presenting to? And should I present this work in white spaces?
You know, there's a question of like, who do I want to face? Like, how do I want to orient my work? And Black people, as Black people, it's important that we think about our communities of other Black people. Mm-hmm. And then it's also important for us to recognize that we have been 12% of the population for a really long time. And that still hasn't really changed. The last census saw a decline in the population of whites in the United States and a rise in people who identify as either other or mixed race or Latinx. Black people, we're solid in that 12% pocket. So that's a way to sort of understand how Black artists have always been oriented towards a general public, which is going to be largely white, because there's just a lot more white people in the US than there are Black people. There are Black artists who orient towards Black audiences. And, you know, I certainly do that in our work in the Slippage group sometimes. So it depends on the project. White privilege in particular was built out for a white audience. Like, that's what it's for. So I don't have a problem with presenting it at a Black theater festival or at Central or, you know, in a Black space, with the caveat that everyone in the room, including myself, would understand that this was built for a white audience. So now you get to see it and experience it and see what you think, but it definitely wasn't designed towards you. It was designed towards a white audience. So, you know, for me, this question of who is the work facing is always super important. Every once in a while, I'll make a work and say it's for anyone, but I really don't think that's a thing. I tend to think about who is this work for and towards. And right. So the question of what your work, this particular project that we're talking about is towards, you get to answer that and say, you know, this is for Black survivors of sexual trauma. This is for any survivor, any queer survivor. You know, you get to say who you want the work to face towards. And then once you say that, then you can decide whether it goes in white spaces, if you will, or Black spaces, if you will. The other thing about that 12%, though, that means even though we're 12% of the population, we only control maybe like 1% of the performance venues. So right. It's really hard to be an experimental artist and orient towards Black audiences. There's just very, very few spaces to do that. Mm-hmm. There are really tiny, tiny number of places to show work in Black space. So that's just also important to acknowledge.
Wow. And so what have you found that to be frustrating?
I'm more of a realist, as you can tell by our conversation. You know, so when I say 12%, I mean, that's a kind of realistic and odd thing to say, because, you know, for Black people who live among Black people, it's like, well, that's our whole life. So how are you going to tell me I'm 12% when everyone I know is Black and my life is in Black family? And, you know,
right.
That's not true for all of us. And, you know, my circles are very mixed, if you will. But I certainly know a lot of Black artists who really live their lives among Black people. And so I think that's when it gets a little tricky, because if you live in a certain kind of world, you start to think that that's the only world. But we do need to know better than that. Like, there are lots of worlds out there.
Right.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with presenting work to all kinds of audiences. It's important to recognize what you're up to, though. That's where I think it's important. So, you know, I don't get frustrated so long as I can have Black audiences, certainly for a number of the projects. White privilege in particular, that piece is designed for a certain kind of audience.
You are a wonderful person.
Aww.
A wonderful, I can't express to you how grateful I am that you're here. I just wanted to remind you of that as we go on. but my heart is so full right now, and I feel like I'm learning so much. Would you say in your experiences that there is a Southern modern dance aesthetic?
That's such a great question. I've really enjoyed living here in Durham, North Carolina for 11 years now. And, you know, I imagine for another, you know, as long as I get to live, like whatever that looks like. And is there a sensibility? Yes, of course. So, you know, there's a sensibility to how work gets crafted, but there's also really importantly a sensibility of who an audience might be, like to connect it to your last question. So how we make work and share it out to people who live here, you know, and we live here too. So yeah, there's definitely a particularity to the work. You know, we take our time with ideas. Exploration of history is really important here in a way that when I was living up in Boston or California, there was just a little bit less interest in that. And down here, I feel like we're all kind of asking questions about history, personal history, family history, you know, locations and what happened where. So there's a sensibility of place, just as you said, being really important here that is super different from my experience in other parts of the US. So that's one thing I would lift up as a difference. And then the sensibility is this kind of careful unfolding. I feel as though projects I make here open themselves out carefully and slowly. And I appreciate that. In a way, it's very different from when I was living in other parts of the country and things were happening really fast. And sometimes I didn't even know I did them. I'm like, wait, what happened to that project? It's already over.
Well, you know, I'm used to working to create a community-specific work to my region. So what should I think about when touring outside of it?
Mm-hmm. I think it's to the degree that you can, to get a sense of who else is making work in that place and what does their work look like and feel like. It doesn't mean your work will be any different than how you feel about it. It'll just give you information to know what those audiences might be used to or what they've seen recently. I just always think that's really, really, really helpful so that you're part of a conversation and not just kind of dropping in with a monologue and, you know, not sure how anybody's hearing it or paying attention to it. So to me, it's always really important to know something about the places you're going and what they're used to or what they've seen recently. I just want to lift that up as something that a traveling artist can do. It looks like I'll be traveling actually to Europe with the piece White Privilege.
Oh, wow.
Later this year. And, you know,
congratulations.
Well, thanks for that. You know, we can't quite tell because of COVID, on again, off again. But right now it's on. And so we're making arrangements. And, you know, it looks like we'll be taking the piece to Amsterdam. So then part of what I do now is, just as I said to you, try to get a sense of who else has been in the venue, what kind of work they're seeing, better understanding how the presenters have chosen this work to be part of their season, so that I don't just go in cold, but have a little bit of a sense of what kind of circumstance I'm moving into.
Is there any literature that you would suggest when thinking about Black dance or Black Southern dance?
We need more literature. This is why, you know, I was one of the folks really trying to move forward this Collegium for African Diaspora Dance. But that organization produces books and magazines and podcasts and video documents. And we have a website, CADD, C-A-D-D. I think it's caddance.org. But, you know, as you're pointing out, we need so much more information that's really particular to our communities and our part of the country and the world. And there's not nearly enough. Most things about Black dance are very general. And then they mostly land on New York, Chicago, and maybe Oakland area, San Francisco Bay Area, because those have been real hotbeds, especially for Black dance artists. But we have had so many amazing artists like yourself who are here in the South, and there's not nearly enough information yet.
Well, I want to thank you for your time and being able to pencil me in to your busy schedule.
Ooh, don't say it like that. Kevin, I'm so glad to talk to you anytime. You know that. And I'm really excited about your process and this project. I can't wait to experience it, you know, in its next iterations. And I'm just thrilled to chat with you through some of these concerns and questions. So thank you.
Is there any way people can keep up with you?
Thanks for asking. So our website is slippage.org. So slippage is spelled slippage.org. And there you can find our publications, our performance projects, our workshops and conferences, all the things that we do over here in Durham, North Carolina. And that's a really great place to just get a sense of what's going on in the Slippage Lab.
Nice.
Thank you to Thomas DeFrance for sharing his deep wealth of knowledge with me. We will absolutely be taking his insights into consideration as we go forward. At this point, we have begun rehearsals and are preparing the show. Thank you so much for coming on this journey with me. This has been Quiet As It's Kept. Our episodes were produced by Joey Lieberman and Nick Zabirla. Quiet As It's Kept is a production of Nonprofit Arts and Education Center Narrative Arts. You can learn more about our work at narrativearts.org. You can learn more about Quiet As It's Kept and Tech Bojé at techbojé.org. That is T-E-C-H-M-O-J-A.org.